Okay, so good morning, everyone. My name is Dharma Sharlan, for those of you who don't know me. And I'm going to talk for a bit, basically. So as Shanti Prabha said before we meditated, today is Dharma Day. So we're celebrating not just that transformation is possible, but that it is communicable, yeah? So the Buddha had a profound transformative experience. In a certain sense, it's relatively easy to have a profound transformative experience. What is more challenging is to sustain that, and even yet more challenging is to communicate it to others. So what we're celebrating is his success in that, his capacity to communicate. And in a way, I'm going to attempt to communicate with you. I'm going to attempt to communicate something that the Buddha said that I have found useful, interesting, stimulating, and attempt to engender interest, stimulation, and usefulness within you. You can tell me how I get on afterwards, yeah? So, what is Buddhism? Yeah, what is Buddhism? Yeah, so here we are, we're celebrating Buddhism, we're celebrating the Dharma, so what is it? One way that it is classically described is the middle way between eternalism and nihilism. Yeah, so that is what the Buddha is said to have discovered, to have realized. He realized the middle way between eternalism and nihilism. So what? Yeah, what does that mean? What does that mean? What is he getting at? How is that relevant to us? Yeah, it's kind of complex words and it sounds quite abstract, doesn't it? So, what he would say, he would have said something along the lines of, well, nihilism is a sort of hedonistic preoccupation with the current moment and soul orientation towards pleasure. Eternalism, he would have characterized as a strong belief in realities outside of this one, and therefore a justification of pain and suffering in the current moment to get benefit in future lifetimes. Yeah, and though those were kind of those, in a certain sense at that time, so we understand, those were the kind of sort of predominant lifestyle choices that were presented to people in India at the time of his awakening. You could either be a nihilist or a hedonist and therefore pursue pleasure through kind of like leading a normal, ordinary consumer lifestyle, or you could pursue eternalism by seeking to, not get reborn anymore, kind of ascend in some kind of way. But anyway, as I say, that for me isn't particularly helpful or relevant, so let's try and get into it a bit more. For Buddha's, one of his characteristic tendencies was that he communicated to people. He didn't particularly communicate abstract ideas. So Buddhism is fundamentally not a system of metaphysics, but a series of observations and practical suggestions. Yeah? So if you don't know very much about Buddhism and you're kind of here trying to work out what this is all about, if you take nothing else from what I'm about to say other than that, then you've done well, yeah? Buddhism is fundamentally not about metaphysics. It's a series of observations and, following on from those observations, practical suggestions. So let's go slow, so let's be observational. What can we observe? Yeah? So one of the crucial things that the Buddha observes, other people observe this as well, of course, is that every moment of experience has certain common features to it. So every moment of experience, everything that happens, has got there's components which are always present. Some of them are obvious, like something happened. Yeah, you can't have a moment of experience where nothing happened. There's a whole series of other ones. But for one I'm going to really focus on today, because I and Buddhism thinks it's extremely important, is the raw tone of our experience, the raw hedonic tone of our experience. Yeah. So what that means is every moment, or for what that's getting at, is that every moment is either pleasurable, painful, or neutral. Yeah, so that's one of the central observations of Buddhism. Every moment of experience can be categorized in one of those three ways. Whatever it is, it's either pleasant, painful, or neutral. That is present in every moment of experience. And of course, when we start looking, it's more complex than that because there's this complex weave of moments of experience, and they're all different. We'll come on to that in a bit. But for a moment, the raw tone of experience is always pleasurable, painful, or neutral. So I'm going to use a few technical words, which I don't normally do, but I'm experimenting. So this is called, this in the Buddhist tradition, this is called Vedana, and it means that raw hedonic tone. Okay, so this is more immediate, more practical. Yeah, more relevant. In a way, you could just ask yourself a question. So what does that mean? What's the implications for my life? Like, do you think about that? Every aspect of our experience is either pleasurable, painful, or neutral. So in some ways, I just find this, as I've been thinking about this, I find this the most interesting thing to think about. So what does that mean that every moment has got a hedonic tone? What does that mean? So to put it one way, or one implication of it, is it means that we all kind of inevitably have a story about pleasure. We must have a story about pleasure because we're constantly experiencing, or we have a story about feeling. Like, what does that mean? What does it look like? We must have a story about pleasure. We must have a story about pain, I suggest. You can argue with me later if you don't think that's true. So when I use the term story, I mean like a set of experiences which inform how we make sense of our lives, how we lead our lives, what we think life is about. So here we come back to this, the Buddha's suggestion of eternalism and nihilism, of a primary views at which we look at life. So is life about pursuing pleasure in the moment, or is life about enduring pain to somebody just get that door, please. Thank you. Enduring pain for some kind of hypothetical otherworldly experience. So today, you'll be pleased to hear, we're going to talk about pleasure. Yeah, we're not going to talk about pain. We're going to talk about pleasure. So I just want you to take literally a minute each, turn to the person next to you, and take turns telling each other something that you find pleasurable, something that you enjoy. Just a minute, go. Aiden. Taking a minute to tell each other about something that we find pleasurable. Go ahead.
Oh,
yeah, or you could go and talk to James.
Well, can I put it in?
Yeah, go on. Thank you. Okay, so that's it for audience participation until the end, so I'm not going to ask you what you made of that. So often what can emerge is, we like pleasure, don't we? Surprise, surprise. You know, given, in a way it's given, isn't it? If every moment of experience is either pleasurable, painful or neutral, then guess what? We want the pleasurable ones. That's sort of completely human, isn't it? It's utterly understandable. But of course, and in a way, this is the main thing I want to explore as I speak, but life's a lot more complicated than that, isn't it? There's all kinds of interesting stories and experiments that people do. One of my favourite ones is these kind of friendly scientist people got these rats, and they injected them with dopamine, which induces feelings of pleasure so consistently that they stopped bothering to move and eventually starved to death because they just sat there being kind of blissed out in a constant state of pleasure. They couldn't be bothered to move, you know, two steps to go and get some food. Lovely, what kind of interesting experiments scientists do, don't they? So it's not as simple as having pleasure all the time. And yeah, in some ways, I invite you to reflect about this kind of later. Well, what kind of stories do you bring to pleasure? What kind of stories do you bring to life? What are the stories you lead your life by or for? So just to kind of give you some ideas, some examples you could think about. This is by no means definitive. It's mainly just thinking about my own mind. So like one of the quite strong ones would be a story of expectation. So I expect to have a nice time, and I get grumpy and frustrated and irritated when it doesn't happen. Yeah. So I expect that I should experience pleasure, you know, predominantly most of the time. I don't like it when it doesn't happen. Stoicism. So I was thinking about it also. So it's quite a wide range of ages in this room, and I suspect that as we move through life, our attitudes change quite a lot. So in a sort of healthy environment, I would assume that children would have quite a high level of expectation of pleasure. If you think about like a five-year-old or like a three-year-old, well, life revolves around play, doesn't it? And you sort of expect that you should just have pleasure all the time, and you don't like it when that doesn't happen. Then you move forward, like 16, 17, 18, again, there's a strong kind of cultural preoccupation with the grasping of pleasure, the sort of headlong rush into experience and the desire for it. And then I wonder, as we age, we move into a kind of a more stoic attitude towards pleasure. It's like, you know, life's predominantly a bit rubbish. You have to go to work and do bad things, but hey, Friday night will be around soon. And then one would anticipate at a certain point after that, you head into a certain level of despondency. It's like life's just a bit kind of rubbish, and you just don't get very much pleasure, and you just predominantly do things that you don't want to do. Yeah. I do feel like I've got friends who I sort of look at them and I think, predominantly live your life on the basis of despondency, don't you? That feels a bit sad. Yeah. One of the other ones I find interesting is anorexia. I don't really understand this, but I've got a friend who describes himself as a sexual anorexic. I find that a really interesting term. What does that mean? There's so many stories, aren't there? Like the no pain, no gain kind of story. I was talking to a friend earlier, and she was saying, she wants to eat chocolate. So she goes to the gym so that she can eat chocolate and not feel bad. Yeah. So it's a deal making, isn't it? You know, we make a deal with life. It's like, okay, I'll go to the gym so then I can eat chocolate. Yeah. It's not a criticism. That's a story, isn't it? It's a valid story. So everyone has a story about pleasure. What's yours? What's yours? And in a way, the question behind that is like, how does that influence the choices you make, the choices we make in our lives? So what's Buddhism's story? Yeah? What's Buddhism's story? Buddhism talks about the middle way between eternalism and nihilism. So what does that look like in relation to pleasure? Yeah? Interestingly, in researching this talk, I googled Buddhism and pleasure, and all of it was about sex. Yeah, that tells you something about our culture, doesn't it? You know, you google Buddhism and pleasure, and it isn't Buddhism and pleasure, it's Buddhism and sex. Yeah. I found that quite striking, actually. I couldn't find Buddhism talking about pleasure, it only spoke about sex, which in a way what that indicates is the strength of a correlation in our society's mind between our cultural assumptions between the direct correlation between sex and pleasure. I find it quite striking. Again, this will be, presumably, this is quite a kind of life stage statement, but I often was struck in my 20s and 30s when people would say, I want to have a bit of fun. And actually what they meant was, I want to have casual sex with people. And it's like, oh, that's interesting, isn't it? That's what fun correlates with sex. Don't worry, I'm not going to talk loads more about sex, just in case you're feeling, So what's Buddhism's story? Well, Buddhism's story, in a sense, is very, very simple. Pleasure and pain come and go. And we're incredibly inclined to get caught up and kind of stuck on a hamster wheel where we're just constantly, we're chasing pleasure, but it just keeps on coming around to pain again, very, very quickly sometimes. And again, this is presumably as we move through life, as we mature, we recognise this and we don't do it quite so simplistically. So there's some really obvious examples, isn't there? It's like, I've had the pain of a crap week at work, so I'm going to go out on Friday night and get drunk to experience pleasure, and then on Saturday morning I'm going to experience the pain of a hangover. So then on Saturday afternoon I'm going to go and get drunk again to get over the pain of a hangover. We just kind of cycle through. Of course, that's very simplistic. I'm not suggesting that drinking alcohol is necessarily bad, and not necessarily any less healthy than any other things we can do. So we're just caught chasing them, or the kind of, the other one very, very common, it's incredibly striking how prone we are to this, certainly amongst my friends. We have our day, and then we want some pleasure, so we go online to look at whatever it is that we look at online for pleasure, and then we stay up too late, and then we go to bed and we wake up feeling tired and done in, and then we don't have a very pleasurable or satisfying day. Phenomenal how powerful that tendency is, how strong that tendency is. So pleasure and pain just come and go. We're caught up in chasing them. Just stop it. Yeah, that's a traditional take of Buddhism's version of Buddhism's take on this. Just stop it. Yeah. But before we say that, let's kind of go into this a bit more. Well, why does Buddhism say just stop it? It says just stop it because the suggestion is that the ratio of pain in life is phenomenal, overwhelming, unbearable. Yeah. Is that true? You can again think about this. Is that true? So I'll tell you my little story, which I like telling. So on my hand here, there's a little scar just slightly bigger than my little fingernail. Yeah? You can't see it because it's too small. I got that scar when I was on retreat and I was in a slight rush and it was dark and I fell over and cut my hand. Didn't quite realise how bad the cut was until I was sitting in meditation and had to sit still for 45 minutes. And what emerged over those 45 minutes was wave upon wave of pain. Yeah, it was a reasonably deep cut. I've never cut myself so deeply, so you could see, I don't know very much about medicine, but you could see like the white kind of flesh underneath, so it kind of gone deep. But I just sat there experiencing wave after wave of pain. And I found myself reflecting on the fact that in those 45 minutes, if you kind of take moment of experience times intensity of the sensation, I was experiencing like a vast number of orgasms worth of pain in those 45 minutes. Like I hadn't had lots of sex up until that point in my life. I haven't had so much sex since then. So I've probably, in those 45 minutes, I've probably experienced more pain, than I will potentially ever experience through the pleasure of orgasm. And that was only 45 minutes of my life, and it wasn't that bad a cut. Yeah. So you may be thinking that says something about the quality of my sex life. But I think it says something about what it's like to be a human being, actually. Sex is pleasurable. Sex is nice. I enjoy it. And if we just look on that level of pleasure, the physical pleasure versus physical pain, it is, the scales don't even begin to balance. There's no way. Yeah, there's no way you can balance those scales. I would suggest. Yeah. The other image I like for this is Schopenhauer, who was a not always entirely happy chappy. So his suggestion that the ratio of pleasure and pain in life was such. Pleasure is like the pleasure a cat experiences eating a mouse, Pain is the amount of pain the mouse experiences upon being eaten. And it's that kind of ratio in life. Yeah. So surprise, surprise, Buddhism says, just stop it. Just get out of it. Get out of the game. Withdraw. Yeah. So, of course, the problem with withdrawal is twofold. Firstly, it's easier said than done. Kind of just stop it. Yeah, but we're completely driven by pleasure. Yeah. And it sounds nihilistic and depressing. Yeah. So one of the major criticisms of Buddhism is it's all a bit nihilistic and depressing, and it just says stop having a good time. Boo. What? In a way, what makes this even worse? This is my bulk of the slightly depressing stories. After that, we're going to do something more positive. In a way, what makes it even worse is that this injunction to withdraw from stimuli, to withdraw, I think it is fundamentally flawed, because human beings are kind of driven towards experience, aren't we? We're driven towards experience. So I was very, very struck sometime in the early mid-90s by reports from the kind of collapsing Balkan states. And there was one in particular where it was talking about Romania, and somebody went into these Romanian orphanages, and they found small, like, babies in kind of metal cribs, headbutting the cribs, yeah, because they experienced so little stimulation, they had so little experience, so little stimuli, that's a non-rational decision, clearly. That's just what they did. They're just like, I want stimulation, I need stimulation. It's a human need, yeah? We're beings which experience. Yeah, it's really sad, isn't it? No idea what happened since then. It's just one of those little, you know, like that was, well, it's in the early 90s. Just really went into my mind. It's like, oh God, that tells you something about life. So, eternalism, nihilism, pursuit of pleasure, the tolerance of pain to get to another world, the inevitable fact that we're constantly having an experience and it is either pleasurable, painful, or neutral. The fact that Buddhism on the surface of it says get out of that game, stop pursuing either. The kind of the question, is that even possible for human beings to do, given our kind of impulse towards sensation, our desire for stimuli? So Sangharakshita, the guy who founded the True Ratna Buddhist community, was asked about this, and they were talking about eternalism and nihilism. And he came up with a different way, and they were talking about the middle way. Yeah? So the middle way, this middle way between eternalism and nihilism, which is one way of the kind of a centre of the Buddha's teaching. And he suggested that a more healthy, a more sane way of looking at the middle way is not, you know, because you could say there's pleasure, nihilism here, there's pain, eternalism here, and the middle way is experiencing nothing, yeah? So that is a common criticism of Buddhism. What Sangharakshita was suggesting, which I think is more helpful, he was saying, well, is there a higher synthesis? And the synthesis that he suggests is the middle way lies in a synthesis of pleasure and meaning, yeah? So he's suggesting that eternalism, what eternalism is kind of looking for, what is at the root of it, is a desire for meaning. A desire for meaning. So we, and in some ways you can see that, can't you? So we put up with pain because we think it means something. And we kind of grasp after pleasure as a way of just kind of having a good time. Again, you can kind of go back to the work metaphor, can't you? So we put up with the work of our week, the week of our work, because it feels, there's kind of meaning to it, and then we go, okay, I've had enough of this meaningful stuff, now I want to go and get drunk. Pleasure, please. Cycle, cycle, cycle. So his suggestion is that rather than do that, we seek to synthesize our lives so that what we find, that our pleasurable activity is meaningful and our meaningful activity is pleasurable. So we bring them together. Clearly, that is easier said than done, but that is the suggestion. So one of the reasons I find that satisfying is it's particularly striking. I've been going over to the university a bit over the last few months, running, helping teach Buddhism to these very bright young 19, 20, 21-year-old kids. And they're, you know, this suggestion that kind of, you know, graying life out, kind of, they just find it incredibly unappealing, and they're very, very reactive to it, in a positive way, I thought. So in some ways, this alternative model, a synthesis, where it's not about lowering our standards, it's not about withdrawing from life and kind of saying, oh yeah, this is all just a bit rubbish, get me out of here. It's about really stepping in. So how can I bring meaning and pleasure fully present into my life? How can I live my life so that it is both meaningful and pleasurable? Yeah. It's not about lowering our standards, it's about raising them. Our standards for the quality of our minds, our standards for the quality of our communication, our standards for our quality of our physical experience, and our standards about the quality of our lives. So I'm just going to briefly touch on quite an important Buddhist teaching, but I'm going to run through it quite quickly. After lunch, we've got an opportunity to talk about what I've been talking about. So if you find this bit interesting, then ask the person who you're with about what I'm on about. So one of the criticisms, one of the problems of Buddhism is that it is easily presented as this sort of slightly stop it, kind of, yeah, there's just pleasure and pain, it just goes around in a cycle, you just stop it, just get off of the wheel. But there is an alternative model, which is more progressive, which is augmentative. And it's interesting that one of the early 20th century translators of Buddhism, when she came across this, which is present all throughout the Buddhist tradition, but it's kind of small, her immediate response was, what would Buddhism be like if this was the major model? Yeah? Rather than pleasure, pain, stop it, it's like, oh, augmentative, an augmentative vision of our lives, the quality of our mental states. So it's commonly referred to as the spiral path, and it goes something like this. We experience difficulty, we experience pain. We find the confidence and the courage to change our experience. In dependence upon that change, joy arises. In dependence upon joy, bliss arises. In dependence upon bliss, concentration, clarity of mind arises. And dependence upon concentration, clarity of mind, freedom arises. Yeah? That's a condensed version. There's additional kind of stages in there. But that's the kind of pith ones. So just kind of dwell on it for a moment. So rather than life being this kind of, kind of get up, go to work, have a crap time, go home, faff around on the internet, eat some nice food, go to bed, wake up, do it all again and again. You know, like living life with a sense of augmentative possibility. There's our experience can transform, it can refine. In association with this, And one of the key perspectives of Buddhism is that it's more interested in states of being than moments of experience. Yeah. So in some ways, that's the answer to my kind of cut finger problem. It's saying, rather than proceed through life trying to attain individual moments of pleasure, can we expand into states of being? Yeah. States of kind of confidence, states of joy, states of bliss, yeah, just living in a world where we kind of feel perpetually blissful. It's interesting, meditation teacher was talking about this, and her teacher said to her, you can get sick of bliss. And she said, come off it, no one gets sick of bliss. She was on this very long, intensive retreat, and she's, 3 months or whatever, and she spent a month in bliss, and she went to him and said, yeah, I'm sick of it now. I've had enough. It's like, oh God, I just want something else. Something more refined. So anyway, coming back to the core point, meaningful pleasure. Yeah, you could look for meaningful pain, but that sounds kind of slightly counterintuitive, frankly. So let's talk about meaningful pleasure. Where do we find meaningful pleasure in our lives? So one good example of this, one easy example of this, is celebration, to rejoice. Yeah, to rejoice. It is good and it feels good. You know what I mean? It is good and it feels good. One of my friends, one of my teachers, was telling me about his, it's just been his sister's 70th birthday, And they went down. He went down for a birthday party, and at a certain point, he kind of in the proceedings, everyone sat around a bit like this, and he suddenly just held forth with his love and appreciation of his sister. Yeah, and I don't know how long he spoke for. Probably 5 minutes, possibly 10. Yeah, and he said afterwards, it's one of those weird ones. He's like, he's a very senior, respected Buddhist teacher in our tradition, but obviously he's just this woman's little brother. And, you know, all of these people, he's just like, oh yeah, it's Uncle Richard. But he's kind of like, just gives forth to these 5 or 10 minutes, just expressing his love and appreciation of his sister, while she's sitting there and still alive, importantly. And everyone was just a bit kind of blasted, but also really, really happy. Yeah. We're not necessarily used to meaningful pleasure, are we? So moving on, so get a bit more practical. So pleasure, pain, neutrality is present in every moment of our experience. So what do we do about that? And in a way, well, one of the most obvious things to recognize is that it's a lot more complicated than just saying that. It's much more complicated, isn't it? Every moment is so complex. The Buddhist tradition does some degree of breaking this down. It talks about kind of healthy pleasure, or kind of, no, beneficial pleasure, beneficial neutral experiences, beneficial painful experiences, and unbeneficial pleasure, unbeneficial neutral, unbeneficial pain. Yeah. So that's some degree of breaking it down. When I first heard that, I found that so useful, because already it gives you an opening, rather than just saying pleasure, pain, neutral, stop it. It's saying, okay, so where's beneficial pleasure in my life? Oh, that sounds good. I want some beneficial pleasure. Yeah. But unfortunately, in a way, one of the dangers of the Buddhist tradition is that it too quickly frames beneficial pleasure in terms of kind of higher mental states, you know, dhyana, absorption. And I, in a way, the whole point of this talk is just to say, oh, hang on a sec, I think that kind of that puts it a bit too far away. We need more immediate access to beneficial pleasure. So I've just come up with my own little kind of set of different categories of experience, which can be happening all at the same time. So in a way, I'm suggesting, you can, again, think about this, is it true? We can have, in every moment, we're having some or all of these different categories where we're having different kind of vedana, different responses. So physical, social, emotional, psychological, mental, spiritual, environmental, ethical. Yeah, and in a way, it's just stating something which we, as we mature, as we go through life, we realize, oh, so you might have a physically pleasurable experience, but which is socially negative. Yeah, so yeah, adultery being a fairly clear example. It feels good, but it's not good. It's causing harm. Yeah. We might have, one of the main ones for me, I'm a celiac, so I'm allergic to gluten. And I've been thinking about it. The most common way for me to get ill is I'm in a situation where it is socially awkward for me to say, I can't eat that. Yeah. So I sort of say, oh, I don't want to create social awkwardness. I don't want to create social pain. So therefore, I eat something which makes me sick and causes me physical pain. Yeah, it's just daft. Yeah, and I'm not talking about a slice of bread. I'm talking about a tiny crumb. It's that I'm that sensitive. So that was quite helpful for me to realize, oh, that's why I'm doing this. I'm prioritizing kind of social pleasure or social not pain over physical pain. Which is daft, frankly. Back with adultery. So this is one of my favourite stories. Some of you will have heard it before. So I like talking to taxi drivers. One of my games, in a way, is to get taxi drivers to talk about what is meaningful in their lives. You know, it's quite good. You've got 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes. You've got enough time. So one of the ways I do this is by asking them what they enjoy. Yeah? So I was talking to this taxi driver. We're about halfway through the conversation, and I asked him, he was kind of like coming up for retirement, so I said, what are you going to do when you retire? And he said, I want to go to Paris, I like gambling, so I want to go to Vegas, and I want to have lots more sex. And I was just like, well, that's, I'm usually frank. So you're the same age as my parents, you can't think about sex. It's a bit younger, but... So there you go, he's got a clear sense of what will bring him pleasure, yeah? I want sex and I want gambling. So great, good for you. So we're kind of talking through, and at some point he mentions his children, and it turns out that he's distanced from his children. I can't quite remember the right word. He's not in communication with his children, or he's full of this tension with his children. So, oh, God, that's instantly, that's sad, isn't it? So then I ask him, oh, what happened? Yeah. So he said, at this point I started thinking, are you having me on? Yeah, is this true? Anyway, I didn't ask him that. So he said, yeah, I loved my wife. We had a really great wife. I really loved my kids. One day I was bored at work. Pain. Well, neutral, you know, so neutral, desiring stimulation. So I texted my wife's best friend with the words, fancy a flirt, ? And she texted back, yes. And that splat, wrecked lives. Yeah. In some ways, it's quite sad, isn't it? You know, like this, you know, it's like he's really prioritized immediate pleasure over, well, kind of social, emotional, psychological kind of well-being. Yeah. And he wasn't a bad man. What was really striking about this, earlier on in the conversation, he was telling me about he was doing taxi runs for this really, really heavily disabled kid. And he had to have like £10 million insurance on his taxi run because she was such a kind of multiply damaged little being that was the level of insurance he needed to be able to drive her, because if she got sick, that's how much it would cost. And he was actively proud of her. So it's not like he was a bad man. You know, none of us are. In a way, that's the point. It's like, oh, there's such a weave. It's a weaving together. And of course, the other primary factor there is time. Do we prioritise immediate pleasure over current short-term, medium, long-term, distant consequences? Okay, need to speed up a little bit, but we're nearly at the end. So what can we do about that? What does it mean? So just a very quick story from the life of the Buddha. So the Buddha, relatively newly enlightened, and he met a young king. And the young king, he was happy, he was good. And the conversation went along the lines of the king saying, so what have you got that I haven't got? I've got health, I've got wealth, I've got fame, I've got beautiful wives, it's all good, you know. I'm experiencing lots and lots of pleasure on lots and lots of different categories. And the Buddha asked him a simple question. He said, how long can you sit still and be content? And the king said, I can sit still for an hour. I do yoga every day. It'll be all good. The Buddha said, okay, what about 2 hours? And he said, well, I could spend the second hour kind of reflecting on my 17 wives and their various virtues. That'll be okay. How about the third hour? The king said, I could kind of go through my elephant collection. And so on and so on. The Buddha pushes it and he says, look, I can sit. The Buddha says, I can sit still and be perfectly content for 7 days. And the king says, okay, you got me. You've got something. You've got something I haven't got. Yeah. Because the king, well, what he was doing was he was sort of short-circuiting meaning. He was just, in a way, he was just deferring pleasure rather than actually combining meaning and pleasure. Whereas the Buddha's saying, look, I kind of feel vividly alive to life, and that's pleasurable. If that doesn't quite make sense, I'm about to unpack it a bit more. So what can we do? What's practical? Yeah. So the first thing you can do is look at your relationship with pleasure in meditation. So when you meditate, you are either experiencing pleasure, pain, or neutrality, because you have to be experiencing one of those. So where's the pleasure? Where's the pleasure? Look at it, value it, kind of invest in it. There's a whole kind of neuropsychology. I've forgotten what the guy's name is, but he's Rick Hansen. It's very, very interesting stuff about the importance of focusing on and allowing ourselves to be with pleasurable experiences more fully. You could say that's a lot of what meditation's about. Yeah. But outside of meditation, what else can we do? Well, we can cultivate freedom from preoccupation Yeah, it's got a nice technical term. I love this word, avipatisara. Yeah, freedom from preoccupation, a sense of kind of ease. Yeah, and primarily the way this ease comes is when you haven't done stupid things, prioritizing short-term pleasure. Yeah, that's one of the major ways of accessing this state. So you haven't kind of, you know, slept with your best friends, your wife's best friend. That's a fairly extreme example. But all these little decisions we make as we go through our days, we've actually prioritized a sense of contentment, a sense of sort of social, mental, psychological well-being. So I had an interesting example on Friday. I was walking through the city centre and there was a guy lying on the floor just in front of me. And you have this sort of classic, weird, avoid, don't go there response. But I'd just been on retreat for 2 weeks, so I was feeling slightly more generous and kind, so I stopped. Fortunately for other people there, he just collapsed. He'd kind of had a low-level overdose, so we phoned the ambulance and all of that. But in a way, that was an expression of... I could have just walked past and ignored him and said, oh, those two other people who are there, they'll have sorted it out. But actually, I'd have carried something with me, which would have kind of weighed on me, so I didn't do that. Yeah. I often describe my first few years of practicing Buddhism as sort of an experience of a kind of free-form therapy, in the sense that just kind of talking all the little knots and kinks, well, not all of them, but many of the knots and kinks in my psyche's out, you know, all of these things I've been holding on to, which I've, the choices I've made, which have caused harm to myself and other people, and just kind of giving them voice, letting them go, expressing them, just feels so much lighter. Yeah. So the value of friendship, the value of ethics, leading a more ethical life and communicating ourselves with others, and the kind of a background sense of freedom and well-being that engenders. We can wisely attend to experience. Yeah, we can wisely attend to our experience. And this primarily means, that one's got another good word, yoniso manusakara. And that means primarily noticing what's the pleasure, pain, neutral, what's the consequences of our actions, where are we placing our attention, what's happening. Yeah. And again, primarily stepping out of the immediate and asking more long-term questions. So... in the early 2000s, I liked watching horror movies, yeah? So in an alternative reality, I'm not a Buddhist teacher. I'm a sort of weird, creepy psychologist who makes disturbing movies to see if you can drive people mad through inciting horror in them. Because I'm interested in how people's brains work. It's fortunately for you and for me, I'm interested in how people's brains work in terms of making people happier, more free. But there's an alternative me which got really interested in engendering madness through presenting people with horrifying images. So anyway, why am I telling you that? So I used to like watching horror movies, but what I realized was I was scared for dark and I liked walking, cycling through a wood at night, and I would be consistently afraid of being axe murdered. And there's, in a way, there's a fairly obvious correlation there, isn't there? So I just realized, stop watching horror films, kind of have more wise attention to what I'm putting into my brain. And I became happier, I became freer, yeah? Again, so Sangha Ajahn places real emphasis on the value of culture, art, yeah. In this regard, you know, if we're, what, just to remind us, what we're primarily looking for is meaningful pleasure, something that is pleasurable, but also like uplifts us, brings more meaning, brings more kind of wholesome joy into our lives. And for many of us, culture is going to be a primary way of accessing that. And culture, I don't mean Shakespeare, I mean, well, what brings you, what uplifts us, what do we enjoy? Music, art, nature. All of those things. Just in time to end. So these two kind of qualities, cultivating freedom from preoccupation, particularly through leading a more ethical life, leading a life where we're in greater communication with others, cultivating wise attention to our experience, particularly through noticing where we can find kind of meaningful, satisfying, wholesome pleasure in our lives. These two are alternative ways of accessing this kind of, this spiral that I was talking about a while ago. So I think that's really important because we do need to find joy in our kind of Buddhist lives, lives of a kind of openness and expansion. If we don't, then we'll leave in this kind of ping pong thing where you come to the Buddhist center on a Tuesday to meditate, and then on Friday, and then you go home and you spend a couple of hours faffing around on YouTube and wake up and feel done in. So it's like, oh no, we need to, how can we bring pleasure and meaning more closely together? Yeah, so that we live for, so they're more and more overlapping. And that's a real problem. That's a real question for me. You know, I was just with a bunch of friends who teach Buddhism, and we're all, that's for many of us, that's the major question of our lives. How can we overlap pleasure and meaning more fully? Because we will seek pleasure. So are we seeking it through healthy, sustainable, growthful, ethical sources, or are we seeking pleasure through ways which actually undermine our sense of well-being, undermine our sense of integrity? Those are the only two choices we've got. So let's finish there. When I'm going to do a quick exercise with most of you. But what the questions you can think about afterwards are, what's your story with regards to pleasure and therefore life? Where in your life is pleasure and meaning in harmony? And what would help them grow? Yeah? So thank you for listening. Those of you who are making lunch, go and make lunch. Everyone else, stay.